And speaking of things alien.
I have found the ones from the TARDIS.
Excellent.
I shall take the patrol and destroy them.
No. Capture them alive. They must be interrogated first.
We were brought here. Perhaps the Dalek was too.
Run, Banjo!
At once, Hawk or you will be exterminated! It is the Doctor! The Doctor must be destroyed! Exterminate! Exterminate! Exterminate!
My first memory of being truly, deliciously, blood-chillingly, agonizingly terrified was watching Doctor Who on the old black-and-white telly as Cybermen and Daleks ruthlessly pursued the Doctor. It never crossed my mind that these sophisticated Daleks hadn't got around to inventing a way to get up and down stairs, or that just like Star Trek, whatever galaxy or time zone, everyone spoke impeccable contemporary English. Suspension of disbelief, after all, is everything, and I've loved Doctor Who ever since. Some Doctors, more than others, inevitable really, given that the number 8 has just appeared on our screens here, and number 9 is working on the next series. For the uninitiated, the Doctor is a Time Lord who foils evil dastardly plans across the universe, through which he travels in a 1950s police telephone box.
Where do you want to start?
The inside's bigger than the outside?
Yes.
It's alien?
Yeah.
Are you alien?
Yes. All right.
Yeah.
It's called the TARDIS, this thing. T-A-R-D-I-S. That's time and relative dimension in space.
The first episode of Doctor Who screened in the UK in November 1963. We saw it here a year later. William Hartnell was the first to play the Time Lord, and after 3 years, he was regenerated, with the fur coat-wearing Patrick Troughton taking over the role. Then followed John Pertwee, Tom Baker, had the long scarf, Peter Davison wearing a blazer, Colin Baker with his massive blonde curls, and Sylvester McCoy with the knitted vest with question marks all over it. Colin and Sylvester are reunited in a new stage show that's about to fly into Wellington and Auckland, Doctor Who Inside the TARDIS. It's been 20 years now since Colin played the Time Lord, and since then he's performed many roles on stage and screen. But he'll always be remembered, first and foremost, as a sixth Doctor. I asked him if he considers this a blessing or a curse.
Yeah, I suppose it's mostly a blessing. Only a curse objectively, because almost by definition, if you are involved with any kind of work that identifies you very strongly with one particular thing, it is seemingly harder for people to accept you as something else. But yeah, I kind of get impatient with actors who go on moaning about that, because why do a job unless you want to do it very well? And if you do it very well, there's always that possibility that you might be remembered for it. And, you know, you don't get many plumbers who people come up to in the street and say, hey, you know, that sink you put in for me 25 years ago, oh, it's brilliant, thank you very much. And they'd be very pleased. So I never know why actors say, excuse me, do you mind talking about this really boring play I'm doing now, instead of, you know, the TV I did 20 years ago. So I'm happy.
Is it the thing you're most proud of in terms of your acting career?
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I enjoyed it, and I felt I did a reasonable job, but, I mean, there are plenty of other things that fit that description. So in terms of my attitude to the work, it's probably on a par with everything else. But I am aware how much it means to other people, which, you know, makes it special.
It does indeed. Well, look, let's get on the TARDIS and time travel back a little bit. I wanted to take you, first of all, to 1954 and your first big break at the age of, I think, 10 or 11.
Good God. You've been doing some research.
I have indeed. That was it's a classic example of knowing the right people, I think, in that one.
God almighty. When I was 11, I was at school in Manchester, and the mother of one of my fellow pupils was the casting director at Granada Television, and they wanted three or four little boys who could speak French. And I happened to... Well, I came top in French that year, so I got the job. And I had to say, Joli Noël, Papa, which means Happy Christmas, Father. It was an English version of I Love Lucy, really, called My Wife's Sister. And I was in a dream sequence in which I was the French offspring of the leading girl in a dream, thinking that she'd married this Frenchman with a moustache. So I was a little blonde boy, 11 years old, with a moustache, saying, Joli Noël, Papa. And that was my first glimpse of acting. But how you got to know about that, we can talk about later.
Well, at that early age, did you think that's what you would do with your life? I mean, how captivating is it as a young fellow being in front of cameras and being on the telly?
Well, I was kind of oblivious of it, as any 11-year-old ought to be, really. I kind of quite enjoyed it, but it was so much outside the world that I lived in that it never occurred to me for a second that it was something that someone like me could have a career in. And it was only after years of... I joined the drama group at school. We did Gilbert and Sullivan every year. And when I was 11, I was playing the girls because it was an all-boys school, so you had to. And I only joined because all my friends did, and it was something to do. And it kind of snuck up on me. It was... It's the old story. You'll get so many actors saying to you, I was a shy boy when I was young. Well, I suppose I was, actually. And the opportunity of being somebody else on a stage, even if it was a girl in Gilbert and Sullivan, kind of released something. Got me in touch with my feminine side. I don't know. And I enjoyed it and found I could do it as well, which was, you know, serendipitous.
You studied law. I was most intrigued by that.
I did. When I was 18, my father said, what do you want to do, my son? And I said, I'd like to go to Oxford or Cambridge and do modern languages, father. And then when I'm there, I'd like to join Ouds or the Footlights in Cambridge and maybe become an actor one day. And there was a kind of very short pause, and he said, fine, you start in the solicitor's office on Monday.
Oh, there
so
you go.
When I was 18, in those dim, distant days, I think we all did as we were told. And I said, oh, all right. So for 5 years, I trained as a lawyer, became a solicitor, and then my poor old father had a heart attack and a stroke, and I suddenly realised that you only get one bite at this cherry called life. And I thought, well, I'm going to do what I want to do. And I threw it all in the air and went off to drama school.
It was the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art.
It was.
And I understand that after 3 years hard yakka, you and a couple of your mates were summoned to the head of the school and given some advice that, thank goodness, you didn't follow.
Well, the principal used to see everybody on their leaving day, and we all filed in one after another. And I was told that the likelihood of my getting work for the first 10 or so years was very small. I'd probably have to wait till I was middle-aged when I kind of grew into myself and had I thought of being a stage manager. And the actor who went in immediately after me was told more or less the same. We were kind of conventional middle-class boys, and it was the age when you had to be kind of chippy and swear a lot and... do unpleasant things in improvisations in order to be respected. So we were kind of overlooked. And the other guy who was told the same was an actor called David Suchet, who you probably remember from the Poirot series, if it's been shown over here.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge hit over here.
Yeah, who has also been rather successful. I like to think now that he was being a little bit clever and he was provoking us to go, we'll show you.
Well, you did show him, too.
I somehow doubt it, though. I think he genuinely meant it. But anyway, here we are.
Well, indeed, you were called to a BBC audition, and I think it was, Roads to Freedom was your first stepping stone, really, in TV as an adult.
It was, about 1971, something like that. They were doing an adaptation of the Jean-Paul Sartre trilogy, Roads to Freedom, and my agent had suggested me for it, and then I went to see this producer, who, quite by chance... he was the only one of his kind, in a way, because I read for this part, and he said, what do you think? And I said, no, I'm completely unsuitable for this. He was a part of a rapist. He was a very nasty character. And, I thought, oh, my mother's going to be watching this. I can't play this part. And I tried to talk my way out of it. Now, I happened to be in the presence of the only producer I've ever met who, if you said, I don't want to do this, argued with me. And he said, well, I want you to. And we stood there arguing. I was trying to turn the job down, and he was trying to give it to me. Now, if I'd adopted that as a strategy with anybody else, they'd have said, well, in that case, you can clear off. But in the end, I agreed, and of course, he was right. I was frighteningly rather good in it.
Well, it is intriguing, because you're also, one of the other key roles we know you for, the man viewers love to hate, as Paul Moroney and the brothers.
Yeah.
And that he, again, he was not a nice man.
No, he was a kind of prototype JR, really. I was voted in 1976 the most hated man in Britain, which, considering some of the politicians who were around at the time, it was rather scary, to be honest. I was. I would get shouted at in the streets because I was some... It was a saga about a trucking company who were three brothers that the audiences all loved, and I came into the series and I was a ruthless merchant banker who took the whole company over and treated them appallingly and... did everything except break the law. Everything he did was legal, which was quite clever, actually, because there was nothing you could nail him for. But it was a wonderfully ruthless part. Great fun to play. Those are the best parts, very often, the villains.
There were great dramas happening around that time, I know, in the 70s, but sci-fi, too, was hot and happening, wasn't it? You had Blake 7, which I know you appeared in.
I guested on that once, yes, as Baban the Butcher, the second most feared man in the galaxy.
Who was the most feared?
Well, Blake.
Oh, of course.
It's called Blake 7, so... and it was something which caused this particular character great angst, because he hated being number two at anything. It was a wonderful study of paranoia.
It was interesting in those times, though, wasn't it, that sci-fi was so fascinating for people. I mean, it is now, but back in the 70s, we didn't have nearly the technology and the understanding, the knowledge that we have now.
Yeah, it was an interesting time because they managed to do so much that, of course, today, you know, given what we can do now with all the various, you know, technological techniques, must look kind of old-fashioned. And indeed, you do get people talking about both things like Blake 7 and Doctor Who, saying, "Ah, I loved Doctor Who when I watched it. Those shaky sets and the awful plastic monsters." But I think their memory's playing tricks with them, because at the time, we thought that was state-of-the-art. Well, it was state-of-the-art at the time. And we bought into it willingly. We didn't think, this is rubbish, but we find it amusing. It's only when you look back on it in later life, you think, hey, surely I wasn't taken in by that. So you construct this false memory. But when it first came out, I remember watching something called Quatermass and the Pit, which was on in the 60s. And now, if you look at it, you can't believe anybody was, you know, even remotely involved in it. But I remember being scared witless at the time.
Same thing with Star Trek, wasn't it? I mean, yes. I've seen some of their props close up because they had an exhibition that travelled the world. And you look at the lasers and you go, oh, for heaven's sake.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
How do we get sucked in? But it's that suspension of disbelief is
exactly
one of the magic things about TV.
Yes, of course. I mean, when you go and see a Shakespeare, you don't say, oh, they haven't really cut his head off. And you, in fact, you sincerely hope they haven't. But, you know, you go there and you buy into it. And that's, as you say, willing suspension of disbelief.
I'm talking to Colin Baker, and this is where we want to hone in on Doctor Who. And actually, you had a bit of a taste for Doctor Who because you played with Peter Davison when Peter was the Time Lord, and he did you in.
Well, I did him in.
Oh,
actually.
You did him in.
Yeah, I was I played Maxil, who was the head of the Gallifreyan Guard, very responsible position, and I was given the task of going along and arresting him. And when he said something I didn't like, I shot him. That was one of the cliffhangers at the end of episode 3. In fact, he was only knocked unconscious, so you'll be all delighted to hear, dear listener. So I'm the guy who got the part by shooting my predecessor, which is... as a result of doing that, I got to know the producer, a guy called John Nathan Turner, who was great producer. Sadly no longer with us, but he was a great man. And at the end of the first run-through, before we recorded the show... He came up to me and said, what's this programme called, Colin? I said, Doctor Who. He said, I'm under the impression you think it's called Maxil the Guard. I said, why do you say that, sir? And he said, because every time the Doctor speaks, you raise your eyes, you sigh heavily, you're acting him off the screen. you're upstaging him, stop it. And I did, and we laughed about it, and we became friends. As a result of which, not because we were friends, but because he thought, I know, just the guy to take over when Peter leaves, he asked me if I would do it, which was quite by chance, really, because I certainly wasn't thinking I was auditioning for the part when I played the character of Maxil.
Was there ever a moment of hesitation when it was offered to you, or did you really want
None
it?
None whatsoever. It was... I mean, it is the part on British television, and every time a new Doctor is announced, you know, the nation gets... either depressed or excited. Depressed if you really loved the incumbent, and excited if you're, you know, ooh, desperate to see what comes next. And it's always been something which has been on the news and newspaper headlines, the new Doctor Who. So it's always been something which is so firmly embedded in British television culture that to be a part of it was just so exciting.
Colin, how much freedom did you have when you got the part? How much freedom did you have to create the Doctor you wanted to create?
Not a huge amount. They were aware how I wanted to play it, and I said that I quite liked the kind of grumpiness and unpredictability of William Hartnell, who was the very first Doctor. And I kind of wanted not to be instantly identifiable as anything in particular. And I thought someone who'd, you know, done what he'd done and been where he'd been might be a little difficult to get a handle on, so might not do the things you expect him to do, and might be a little arrogant. And they certainly took that on board, but really, whatever they wrote, I had to do. And I think also that Tom Baker, who played it for 7 years, towards the end had wanted to contribute quite a lot to the part, and they sort of learnt, I think wisely, that, you know, we all have jobs to do. Writers write, directors direct, and actors act. And if you blur those lines too much, it can get a bit unwieldy. So I was certainly on, you know, at a time when, you know, you did what you were told to do.
What about the writing? Because I know that there's been some criticism of some of the writers that you had over your time, that the scripts perhaps weren't as strong, or I think in the words of the BBC controller, it was sort of too violent, and, you know, the storylines are becoming farcical. What was your take on the stories that you acted on?
Yeah, these things are cyclical. I mean, the whole violence thing. Certainly the time I was doing it was the time when the League of Viewers or something. Mary Whitehouse was quite a powerful lady in Britain at the time, and she'd founded this kind of decency league, if you like, and they were complaining about violence on television and too much sex on television, and they homed in on Doctor Who as being too violent. And in fact, if you compare my time with the time of Tom Baker in the 70s, it was certainly no more violent, and possibly a little less, but what happens is the public has a different attitude towards it. So you have to kind of tailor what you do to what the public hope and expect you'll do for them. But in fact, I don't think it's fair to say that it was. They single out a couple of incidents of my time when I allegedly threw two people into an acid bath, when in fact, if you watch it, all that happened is that they were trying to throw me in, and I moved out the way. but, you know, because the general feeling was that you can't do anything violent, they seized on that and kind of used it wrongly in a way. And Michael Grade had come to the BBC in 1985-ish with a history of having not liked the programme. Before he came to the BBC, he said he thought Doctor Who was past its sell-by date. So it was kind of understandable that he would rather bizarrely snipe at his own programme once he got there.
What was it like for you? Talk me through a kind of a day on set of Doctor Who.
Kind of like any other job, really. You turn up in the morning, you hang around for a certain amount of time while they get everything else right, you get on the set, you rehearse it and you do it. I'm afraid it's one of the most boring things for someone who isn't in the business is coming along to the studio to watch what's going on. At first is that great kind of thrill of, I'm going to watch a recording of Doctor Who. And then activity seems happening in little flurries, and then there's great periods of nothing much happening. There usually is a lot happening, but nothing that's outwardly visible. And you, of course, with a technological show like Doctor Who, there are all the sound effects and the InVision effects and the props that have to work. And if they don't work, you do it again and again and again until they do. And on that take, when everything else works, irrespective of whether your performance is halfway decent or not, that's the one they'll buy. So you do have to keep up the energy and get it right every time.
Comparisons for any actor odorous, and you touched on this before, but with Doctor Who, because you're directly playing, you know, in a line of characters, as you say, there will be people who have their favourite Doctor.
Oh, yeah.
Is that quite hard when criticism comes your way and that you're not the Doctor John Pertwee was, that sort of thing?
Yes, of course it does. And you do get people coming up to you in the street saying, could I have your autograph, Mr. Baker? I love Doctor Who. You were my fifth favourite Doctor. And kind of think they're being complimentary, you know, because there's a couple that even below you. That's kind of quite entertaining. Yes, nobody likes to be criticised, but, you know, I'm an actor. You know, if I do a play, someone's going to review it, and I will have to read that review somewhere unless I choose not to. And I never believe actors who say, I never read reviews. They only say that because it means they don't have to talk about them. I always read them, and some are... for the same night, the same show, you can get one saying you're the best thing since sliced bread and the other one saying you're rubbish. So it all goes to prove that there are no absolutes in this business. For some people, I'm their least favourite Doctor. For others, I'm their most favourite Doctor.
Do you have a favourite moment of being a Time Lord?
I think working with Patrick Troughton, I did one story with him. He was the second actor who played Doctor Who. And for me, he's the one who did the difficult job. Because after 3 or 4 years of William Hartnell, he decided he didn't want to do it anymore. And that could have been the end of the programme. But somebody came up with the wizard idea of regeneration. Not simply replacing the actor, but making a virtue of it. And had that particular actor not done such a wonderful job, I wouldn't be here talking to you now. So for me, Pat Troughton was the governor. You know, he's the guy we all look up to. And I did a story called The Two Doctors with him, and he was just such a wonderful, generous actor that working with him was a special privilege.
I was in the UK when Doctor Who was canned or put on ice with Sylvester McCoy, and the outpouring of kind of grief in the country was phenomenal. I was amazed the BBC stuck with it. And lo and behold, 2005, the Doctor is back.
Yeah, and within a few weeks of him coming back, Michael Grade came back to the BBC as chairman of the governors. And everyone went, oh, no, the man's back, because he's the one who killed it. But, I mean, he is now so far removed from programme-making decisions that everyone can be reassured. And it's come back with a vengeance. It's excuse me, it's so good now, because the technology has moved on exponentially, and what they can do now and the look of the programme. I was a bit nervous because I thought, oh dear, what's it going to be like? They're either going to go so far away from the original that we won't recognise it, or slavishly stick too closely so it's not the new fresh programme it needs to be. And golly, was I wrong. They've really captured it perfectly. It's nice to be able to be generous about it because there's no effort involved. I can't fault it in any detail, actually. The scripts are magnificent. The look of it is... I love the new TARDIS. The interior of the TARDIS is quite different, and I envy them in all the programme, really. And Billy Piper as the companion is absolutely brilliant, because I thought, pop singer, being an actress, come on. She... I don't know if you've seen any of them.
I have not.
No, she's very, very good. And they deal with issues that haven't been dealt with before, about what it's like for the companion who is taken off in a TARDIS. What happens when she goes back home and meets up with her friends and she's been missing for a while and tries to tell them where she's been? And they investigate that, and they do it brilliantly. It really is very good. I won't spoil it for anyone because, you know, I think you're halfway through seeing it over here.
Oh, it's just started. We've just had the first two episodes. I lied to you because I misinterpreted your question. I had seen it. What intrigued me when I watched the first episode was I thought, gosh, you know, the budget spent on special effects in this episode was probably more than spent on the entire first, second and third series of Doctor Who.
I mean, the special effects have got cheaper, so it's not quite as bad as you're saying, because you can do a lot more with the money now. But having said that, yes, the whole look of it reeks of investment. They're investing in the future, and the second series is in production, and the third series is being planned. So the world is a happier place. And my own children, who, you know, when Doctor Who stopped, weren't of an age to watch it, and are now in their teens, have finally got their own Doctor.
What is working with the fans? You said before about getting autographs and things like that, but there is a sort of an obsessive nature sometimes with these kind of programmes, aren't there? I mean, I know that Lucy Lawless from the Xena series here has been at conventions, sci-fi conventions, and seen big hairy men of 6 feet wearing Xena, you know, dressed outfits, you know.
Indeed.
They can take this terribly seriously, can't they?
Oh, yes, and as you might imagine, there are scores of people turn up at conventions I'm at wearing my costume, and that's quite difficult because it's a very tricky costume to duplicate, but they manage it. They get their mothers and their sisters and their aunts to make them for them. There is a tiny percentage, and it is a small percentage, of fandom that perhaps carry obsession to slightly unhealthy limits, but there's an awful temptation to characterise them as the typical fan, and of course they're not. The typical fan is someone who enjoys the programme so much that they're intrigued by the notion of meeting the Doctor or listening to someone talk about it and come to conventions, of which I go to quite a few of, as you might imagine.
What do you think it is about this series, this character, that really has invested itself and entrenched itself in the British psyche? Because it has. It's as British as, you know, fish and chips and soccer, really.
Yeah, in the beginning it was a mixture of chance and cleverness, in a way. Back in 1963, it was innovative. I mean, it was a new idea, a new programme. The Britishness lies in the fact that this character, this Time Lord, is a bit of a... I suppose... I hate to characterise the British as being amateur, but there is the cult of the amateur in Britain, which fortunately we have moved away from now, and especially in things like sport, where we do try and approach it a bit more professionally. But the old amateur thing does even hang on in sport, which is not terribly helpful always. We can move on to the cricket later. And there is something about the Doctor which is, you know, he's kind of disarmingly casual about everything. He's a Time Lord. He can travel through time and space, and yet he fishes bits of string out of his pocket and is forgetful and is kind of irrational and unpredictable. And I think that is quite an interesting character. And he's a kind of everyone's kind of forgetful uncle or grandfather.
Colin Baker, the sixth Doctor Who, who'll be answering your questions at the stage show Doctor Who Inside the TARDIS, coming to Auckland and Wellington. And here's Blam Blam Blam's take on the show's famous theme.